Oh, I hate reality shows.
Not to worry. Nothing but fabrication and fantasy on the Amy the Dark Way Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. By the way, most reality shows do the same. How are you? We made it to Friday. It's been a tough week in the world for sure. We are back in Iraq. Limited airstrikes so far as we battle ISIS. And the truce is over in the Middle East. Hamas has already fired rockets again at Israel. To add insult to injury, Newark was just named, second year in a row, the unfriendliest city in the U.S. Dang, there go my vacation plans. Hope you're doing a little bit better. We'll talk about all of that. Some monkey business, too, in our free-flow pop culture convo. Also commemorate the 40th anniversary of Richard Nixon's historic resignation and all that surrounded that. Inspiration to action, shout-outs as time permits. We'll get you on the line, too, should you be listening live on Friday, August 8th, 9 a.m. out west, 11 central, noon here in the east. Number in motion, 347-857-4505. You know about our 24/7 Twitter feed at AB Writes, and we're trying for the first time our Blog Talk Radio chat room, egged on by a couple of other BTR hosts. I think this is only available if you are registered with Blog Talk Radio as either a host or a user, a listener. But we'll try it. We'll try all of these things. And welcome aboard. If you're in, we're happy to have you here. The show today brought to you in part by Netflix, now streaming today's entertainment, and by Toyota. Test drive the RAV4. Toyota, let's go places. So speaking of going places, we're going to go back to childhood with our guest author, Catherine Lippa. You know, there is an old writing school adage that says if you survived your childhood, you could have a lifetime of material to write about. And she certainly has gotten herself started here with a fascinating memoir. It's called Hiding in Water, a memoir based mostly in reality. She recounts her family's history. Her parents met in a cult back in the 60s. Her father thought, in fact, he was a prophet from another planet. So there's a lot to talk about there. Their bitter divorce, all kinds of things seen through the childhood lens of magical thinking. Fascinating read indeed. Catherine, a pleasure to welcome you to the show. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you here. So let's talk a little bit about why you chose to write this as a memoir instead of maybe fictionalizing it. I know memoir has been, I guess it's kind of the it genre for the last few years, although it's maybe tipping off a bit. Yeah, go ahead.
You're right. It really has. I mean, it has in many ways replaced the first novel. It used to be that people would write their first novel, but I think now because of the advent of reality television, we really have a culture that hungers for knowing too much information about everybody else's business. So
yeah,
I thought,
that's
well,
right.
I guess I'll join in.
And you have a lot of information to share, for sure.
Well,
and
thanks.
You do it.
Yes.
what kind of reaction did you get from your? And it's always interesting with people who write memoirs how their families react to it, and people have different comments on that. What was the family's take on the book and the project?
Well, it's been mixed. I've gotten probably better reviews from people with whom I'm not related or to whom I'm not related, but there have been cousins of mine who really found it very interesting. My mother actually had a very interesting reaction before it really clicked in that this was going to be out there in the world. She had this great response of saying, this is really well written and such an interesting story. And then a couple of days later, she went, oh my God, wait, but it's going to be out there for people to see?
Yeah. Well,
but
your parents, I think I had a writing teacher tell me once, you know, your parents are not probably going to be your best audience. You know, parents and family members don't always want to read the truth as you see it.
That's true. And that's what it is. That's as I see it. And that's why part of the reason why it's called a memoir based mostly in reality, because I have memories of my childhood, but certainly they're going to have a very different perception of what happened. And it really is a fallible craft in that way.
Yeah. Well, go write your own memoir. That's the response, right, for the family
member.
Right, your version.
I'm sure it would be very good. I'm sure it would be very good. They're fascinating people.
Yeah. Oh, well, clearly they're fascinating people. But were you nervous? I mean, were you nervous about putting it out into the world? And especially having them see
it? I had a couple of moments, but I really had a lot of preparation for this, too. I spent 3 years taking notes and then 6 months going through lots of legal documents and medical documents and then 6 months of complete procrastination. So by the time I actually started writing it, I felt like, okay, I'm ready to do this. And there were a couple of moments where I felt like, oh, gosh, this is going to be a bit of a hard a hard part to write, or I'm not sure if I really want to put this out there. But I think ultimately I found a good balance between sharing what is appropriate and not oversharing so much.
Yeah, interesting. Did you have them read it before you actually published it so that they could say, I don't want to put this in there?
Yeah, I did. And I put the offer out there to several people because my English teacher is mentioned in it. And as part of a follow-up memoir, I actually dated him 10 years later. So it's a very odd setup to talk about him at the very end of the book and present him as this kind of weird father figure that on whom I had a crush, knowing that, you know, I'm going to do a follow-up,
The English teacher with the lovely supportive wife, you were dating her 10 years later.
Oh, they divorced. Oh, sorry. Yes, they divorced.
I figured something must happen.
Yeah, sorry. I figured it'd be a homewrecker, too. You know, no, I'm kidding. That was long after their divorce.
Well, you'll have a lot more material because you leave us at the threshold when you're going to college, so you have plenty of time to – certainly there's going to be another volume or two or three or four if you so choose to go down that memoir route. But you did a lot – you said it's interesting because you did a lot of research. A lot of people just write down how they remember the particular incident in their life. You pretty much took yourself from childhood all the way to going to college. That was your span. Because a lot of memoirs are just like a period of, you know, a year in a person's life or one tragic experience or something like that. So you did a lot of research on your family, and as we said, your family kind of met in an interesting way. It was back in the 60s.
Yes.
Your parents met in a,
yes.
I guess you could call it a cult. Maybe they didn't call it a cult. They called it a religious.
Well, my mother once asked my mother what the difference between a religion and a cult is, and she said it's tax status. So I would say that since they didn't have tax status at that time, that you know, technically it would be a cult. But I do think eventually they got some form of recognition for their group. So I guess eventually it would have been a religion. I'm not sure.
I always think of a cult as a place where if you go and then you want to leave, they like excommunicate you, throw you out, and you can't come back again. You can't, or while you're in, you can't speak to your family and that kind of thing. That's kind of the impression that most people have about a cult.
Yeah, and that's really a part of what happened. My mother went through a very tough period of time as a result of that, and suffered a significant loss in her own life that is written about in the book, but it's really something that was a great struggle for her, and it was because of that desire of groups to sort of isolate people from others who might care about them but would have different perceptions of the situation. So
yeah, right. So your family, I mean, your father.
That's my cagey way. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Not at all. Don't worry about it.
I was going to say that's my cagey way of putting that, since I do write about it in the book, and it's quite a pivotal plot point for me. So.
Right. Yeah, you don't have to give away too much. We want people to we want to get people interested in the book. We don't want to give away everything. But
exactly.
Talk about your dad, because you had some interesting – he obviously was an interesting character for sure.
Yeah.
He plays an important role in the book and your life, and their parents' divorce, of course, was a very hard thing for you as a young child. But talk about him. Even you did a lot of research on him and his family background and what he did before you were even born.
Yeah, he's a very interesting guy. Was raised in a not orthodox but fairly conservative Jewish household, and he converted to Sufism, which is as he calls it the friendly sect of Islam, and he held beliefs that the mind has great power, and if one wants to be able to levitate or move buildings, they can do that, and so that was basically his training. I mean, his parenting style was based on a premise that all people have a psychic nature, and if you get access to a child early enough, then you can harness that and grow it. And I was a very willing participant in the experiment until the day came that I thought that my great magical powers caused a very tragic incident. So, but I adored this. It's like, oh, I have magical powers? This is great. And now he's mellowed some as he's gotten older. I actually reconnected with him recently for the first time in many years, and he certainly has mellowed, but he's also still got that very unique perceptive edge of what it means to be a human being in the universe rather than just in a state, in a city, in a country. So,
does he read the book, and what was his reaction to it?
I don't know if he's read the book yet, to be honest with you. We bonded together in taking care of a family member, and part of it's just that I haven't had time to ask him, and part of it's that I'm so enjoying reconnecting with him that I have to tell you I have a little trepidation about it. But who knows? Once he Googles my name, there might be a few.
Are you trying to tell us that he doesn't even know about the book?
I don't know if he does or not, to be honest with you, because
Of
the family members that I did present the book to, he wasn't one of them because I hadn't been in touch with him for 17 years. So, So this is going to be kind of an interesting thing. He's actually a very accepting guy, though, and I don't know that he would find anything in the book that he'd really disagree with. So, he actually comes off pretty well in some ways. Comparatively.
Well, yeah, maybe. Yeah, I mean, he's your dad, and he loved you as a little kid, and he was very seductive. The idea of magical powers is certainly seductive to a child. There's no question about that. But I don't know if he really comes off heroically with.
Not heroically. I don't know that anybody comes off heroically in that book, but yeah.
Well, you come off as real people, but. But your mom certainly is probably a more stable figure and somebody who tried harder, and at least she tried to keep the family together and all of that. So that comes through.
Yeah.
With whatever her flaws may have been. But it's definitely an intriguing read. It'll be fast. So you have plenty of material if you want to do part two and beyond. You can have just a book on reconnecting with your father if you wanted to.
I know. That'll be number four.
There you go.
I'll quote this interview because, you know, the first person who found out that I have reconnected with my father who doesn't know or may or may not know that I have a book. I'll quote you.
Well, we always like to break stories here. I mean, I love to break the news wide open. Our show has gone viral a few times. Something salacious happens, we're ready to go. We can get it into the world, as they say. I mean, the good thing about these radio shows is they're little under the radar little things, but they're podcasts, so they're forever.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you may have just changed the landscape of my weekend. I'll tell you that.
Interesting. Okay, always a pleasure to help out whenever we can. But it is fascinating, the idea. You also do a lot with this idea of, as you said, magical thinking and childhood and what we believe and perceive. And you were a very deep thinking young child, and a lot of it, I guess, had to do with maybe just the DNA and also growing up with your parents and the stories they told you and the way your father was. But you did have, I mean, you were attuned at a young age to things that were happening in the world. Like I was speaking of in the intro, things in the world are a lot of strife. You took that on yourself. You had a kind of a correlation somehow in your mind in the late 70s, 79, I guess, with the Iranian hostage crisis and how that related to your parents' separation. I guess they separated around that time. And if the hostages came out, your parents would be able to rekindle their relationship.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about that and how, as a young child, you got involved in watching the news and connecting it to your own life.
Well, we were a news-watching household, and that was just such an image that was repeated on the news so often, the burned-out helicopters trying to make a rescue to get these hostages out. And it was a huge part of the zeitgeist. And the way, in my own personal life, I had made these magical associations that if I could will them back from Iran, that would somehow mean that my father would come back as well. But the way I sort of liken it to things nowadays are the kids that were maybe 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 when 9/11 happened, that for them that just impacted their lives and the way that they formed their views of their world in such a great way. And even though the Iran hostage crisis is not in our historical books as prevalently as 9/11 is or will be, it was still a huge part of our culture during that period of time. And so lot of people were talking about it. So, and that part of the framing of the book is through that perception of that crisis and the Cold War and the Iran-Contra affair. And I think that these are things that even if kids weren't maybe thinking about it as much or in as kind of obsessive a way as I was, they were still thinking about it and we were all still talking about it. So that's why it had a meaningful impact.
Yeah, definitely. I think you're right about that. I mean, you were obviously more attuned because, as you said, your family was watching the news and you had turbulence in your own household, et cetera. But I think so many things do just seep into our cultural consciousness, and even more so now. I mean, I think you're so right about kids today because we have that 24/7 media matrix. Things are always churning. The images are on. I remember when 9/11 happened and just watching it over and over again and thinking, oh, my God, with kids watching these over and over again, they think it's – in fact, we did shows on, radio shows on at the time, with psychologists that would say, this is not good because they think it's still, it's happening over and over again. You know, young child's mind can't process it. It's so, it's even more painful. But, you know, your experiences, as we know, and we learn in counseling and psychology, everybody's story is important. And if you think, you know, other people have more tragedy or more poignant stories, the truth is your story is your story. So to you, it's the most important story. So anything that impacted
you is, and I think that's what I wanted to be able to say. I, if I had a brand, it would be Healing Through Humor. Even though there are some dark parts of the book, I try to kind of bring light to some parts of our lives that other people can relate to as well, that if you can't laugh about it, then what's the alternative? What I tried to do is to find a universal topic, that idea of magical thinking, and present it in a way that was just unique, but that people could relate to, because I think we've all had those experiences of even just thinking Santa Claus is going to come. That's a form of magical thinking, you know.
And then for the families where Santa Claus, you can't afford Santa Claus to come, that's a real letdown for kids. So,
yeah,
you're right. I mean,
and that's a real, and why isn't Santa coming to my house, you know, that. It's a perception is a very, very interesting thing. It can change every aspect of a conversation or even reality.
Definitely. And the idea of the magical thinking aspect of, you know, if I will something, and as you said, there was a tragedy where you thought you caused a horrible thing to happen.
Yeah.
Same thing with, I always say, with people who, you know, pray for miracles, and sometimes miracles do happen and people have healing, but then it's, I always think about the people who don't get the healing and what they think. Well, how come I can't get it if I'm praying? And you know, because there's so much to this human condition that we don't really know, and you know,
exactly.
It's mysterious.
Well, and that's the beauty of it. I wish I had some great thing to add to what you just said, but I don't. It's just a mystery. It's fascinating. It's a mystery.
Yeah, really
maybe
is.
One day we'll figure it out. We'll all use
a
bigger part
won't.
Of our brains or something.
Religious people, I guess, think you figure it out later. You'll get all the answers after you go. I don't even know if that's true.
Yeah,
even if there is something beyond this, I don't know if you get all the answers. I don't think you ever get all the answers.
Exactly. I know. I used to
maybe that's part of the fun.
Well, yeah. When I was a kid and I had a lot of religious beliefs as a child, and one of the things that I thought heaven was like is that you'd find out all of the answers, not just like the answers to life, but like the answer to that question you got wrong on that test in third grade that always bugged you. Like you'd find out everything. That to me was heaven, is knowing everything.
Knowing everything, yeah. And when you're if you pray for something like a toy or getting a good grade or something, then you feel guilty afterwards, all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's interesting the way your perceptions and so forth change. But I think, you know, a lot of this mystery of figuring things out also applies to writing, the craft of writing. I often find that I sometimes procrastination is fueled by the idea I don't want to finish it because I don't really want to know yet, maybe. You know, I want to hang on to that story because sometimes there's something great. Nothing, as we all know, I'm sure you know this too as a writer, nothing ever comes out the way it is in your head. It's always different, and sometimes it's better, but it's always different.
Right.
But I think sometimes I'm fascinated by something, and then once I write it, it's like, that's it, I'm done? I mean, that, you know, like I want to hang on to some of the things that I haven't written yet that I think I should have already been working on or been percolating in my mind and walk around with these ideas. And part of the reason they haven't, maybe they're just not ready yet to come out, that's one of it, but it's also maybe I'm not ready to let them out and to really figure out what it's all about, because once you write it, the mystery is sort of diffused, if not gone.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And part of it is that percolation process of ideas bubbling. But yeah, once it's done, it's a little sad. When I finished the first draft, and there have been many, but when I finished the first draft, I was really glad that it was, you know, being read by people, and it sort of had a took on a life of its own so that others could read and evaluate it. My editor was reading it, but I felt very sad that it was that part of it was over, that the first draft was over.
Yeah, there's definitely a loss because you're done.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Yeah. Well, now I brought down the mood. Sorry.
No, not at all. What are some of your influences as a writer, as a reader, and how have they changed over the years?
Well, they've changed a lot over the years. I mean, Harper Lee is somebody that I just admire so much, and I think so many people do, because To Kill a Mockingbird is just a brilliant, brilliant book. And you had asked about writing it as fiction versus nonfiction, and when I was considering writing it as fiction, that was what I was thinking of. And ultimately, I felt like it was a book that needed to be told as truth because it was such an odd subject. But when I was considering it, that was whose book I was thinking of. She's just got, I wonder what her hidden treasures are that she might have in her file cabinets that she's been working on for many years. And
let's hope, because we're still waiting for that second follow-up book. I hope she's not been blocked all these years. Because, it's interesting. Because I'm sorry to interrupt you, but just the idea of her being paralyzed by the success of that first book. You know, think about it. I mean, that's why I say obscurity. There's something that he said about obscurity. You can keep going.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. I thought about that once because, of course, one imagines this life where you're, the lights are shining on you and everybody wants to use $1 million to make the movie. I'm like, oh, this would be fabulous. And then I thought, oh, my goodness, what would my follow-up be? Oh, and I started getting a little panicky, and I thought, well, this is great. I can coast along under the radar. I'm getting good reviews. And eventually, once I build a library of books that I've written, then who knows? Maybe then the lights will shine. I think you're right.
She has
said. Paralyzing. Yeah.
Yeah, she has said that there was a time when she really wished she hadn't written the darn thing, I think was the quote. So it really overtake her life in a lot of ways. Yeah. It's a tough thing. There's a new book out, I forget the author now, who just wrote it, called The Mockingbird Next Door. It's a book about her. I guess she got to interview her. She was a journalist with the I wish I had the name. See, I hate it when people don't know writers' names. I always do that, but I do that myself sometimes. She was a columnist with one of the Chicago papers, and she had a chance to meet her and interview her.
Wow.
And there was some talk that Harper Lee had not been happy with the book, but then she came out and said that's not true. So I don't know whether it's true or not.
Wow.
But I haven't read the book yet, but it sounds interesting. And
very interesting.
To talk about her life and her sister, I guess, also helps her with the legacy of this book, which just keeps going. I mean, we've all read it in school. Although I just got kicked out of the UK, a snobby education minister in the England who has kicked out most American books for their required reading.
Oh, that's right. I was reading about that. Isn't that nice of him? Well, geez.
Yeah, really.
I didn't,
including To Kill a Mockingbird, which he didn't.
Yeah, which he didn't care for much, apparently.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I did just
but
Google
yeah,
it
the idea
because
of
I
having...
was so curious, and it's written by Marja Mills. The
Mockingbird
Next Door. There, plug
there
for Marja Mills.
There you go. Thank you, Marja. Yeah.
Thank you, Marja.
But we'll take a look at that book. I haven't read it yet, but
I thought
about what it must be like life after you write your masterpiece. I think about that with Michael Cunningham too. Although he's written many books, but after he wrote The Hours, nothing compares to that really. And what is it like that you have to go back and face the page after that and write? And he's written a couple of books since that they've been decent, but they haven't, frankly, been brilliant.
Right.
I don't have that problem yet. So.
Well, that's good. Excellent.
Yeah, right. There's a good spot. It's interesting how your perspective changes as you get older, because I certainly was somebody out of the gate who had high expectations and some early signs of success that kind of took a couple of detours down the road, as most of us do. So, and then you kind of modify the way you look at things and what you expect and what you want, frankly. And sometimes, you know, it's the Truman Capote book that never really got written, Answered Prayers. Be careful for what you wish for. If you get it, what happens?
That's right. That's right. That's what a friend of mine calls that unauthorized unauthorized expectations. And I like that phrase a lot, where we expect things from other people or from our lives or from situations, and then recognize, oh, wait a minute, there was no reason that to believe that this was a sure thing or a sure bet from the start. So unauthorized expectations that phrase has helped me a lot when I start thinking.
But you know, when you're a kid, when you're young, you expect a lot, and that's probably a good thing in a way. I mean, there's a letdown effect,
I
get that.
Yeah.
But you have to be fueled with some ambition. You have to be fueled with some delusion. I think that helps you go, or else you're never going to do it. You're never going to try it. If you really believe nobody's ever going to read this, then you're not going to get started. And I think the age that we live in now, especially people who are young now coming up, they really have no excuse. Because we used to be in the old days. You know, I still remember a time when publishing was a very closed-off kind of business, and you really had to rely on a gatekeeper. Now people are putting their stuff, sometimes ill-advisedly, putting their stuff out there by themselves without it being vetted or edited or all of that.
Right.
And there are a lot more, you know, there's still it's a hard nut to crack, the big publishing houses, although there's so many fewer of them, and the bounty that you get in terms of financial bounty is much less than one would expect, and probably always has been, by the way, but there are other opportunities, and there are certainly smaller presses and self-publishing and all these things which are much more accepted and easy to do, so you really don't have that excuse of, well, why bother doing it because no one's going to publish this. If you want to do it, you can publish it. You know, you can
get
it out.
That's true. I agree 100%, although I have to say that part of my procrastination, besides the percolating, was because for those 6 months I thought, okay, I'm finally going to put this on paper, and wait a second, what if it's not good? What if nobody reads it? What if I fail? And so there was a part of that process that I had to, where I had to address those feelings in order to move on. But I think you're right. There isn't really an excuse. I mean, in this country, there are 380,000 books that are published each year. And who cares that some people are making money and some people are not. I mean, I'd love to make more money from my writing, but the fact that I have people who actually want to read it is pretty amazing, and that's so satisfying as an artist, as a writer. It's just incredible to be able to say, yeah, somebody just read my book and emailed me and told me that they really liked my book, and I don't know who this is, and, you know, it's just an incredible feeling. It's an incredible feeling. It's that part of it is just a dream come true. It's just amazing.
It sure is. Yeah, fan mail is very seductive, too. I will say that. I've gotten, you know, a little bit of share of that. Nice to get that. So let's get back a little bit to other influences. I know you said Harper Lee, but have you read other memoirs, other nonfiction writers?
You know, one of my favorite memoirs is actually by Stephen King, and I've never once read any of his other works. I have no idea. I mean, I've never read any of his scary books, but I read On Writing, which is a really tremendous memoir, and he talks about his struggle as a writer and the experiences that he had in childhood that influenced the work that created. And he talks a lot about the experience of throwing out the manuscript for Carrie because he thought it was horrible.
Yeah. And his wife was the one that recovered it, right?
Yes, who rescued it from the trash can. And I thought, oh, my goodness, this is – I mean, what a brilliant – it was so inspiring, and it made me feel really good. You know, when you're kind of starting out, you sort of cling to those influences from people who have, quote unquote, made it, but who also had those personal insecurities as well. And so
that meant a lot
for me to read that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, think about Stephen King. Has his wife not recovered Carrie, that career would be over.
Yes.
He would have had that book, which was a pretty big phenomenon in its day and still is, and all that followed. But really, that's
New York. Oh, I was going to say he might still be in New York doing cocaine.
Well, wasn't he a teacher, substitute teacher, or custodian, or something up in Maine? Right.
That's right. I forgot. The cocaine started with the film stuff. See, it's another reason why it's good that I haven't made it big yet. Who knows what would have happened?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there is something that he said with. I always said, you know, I really did expect, frankly, I'm not going to talk about my life, people have heard it before, but I did expect early success. There was some indication that it would happen, and it didn't happen. But maybe you're right. I don't know. I think I'm a pretty grounded person, but who knows? You know, I think a lot of people who do get early success don't really handle it too well, and I think by the time you get a little older, you do have, you know, a little more perspective, let's put it that way.
Oh,
so,
I think
you don't know.
Yeah, I was insane in my 20s, and even in my 30s, there was still a little edge of, okay, I'm not sure if it's good, crazy, or you know. But now so I feel
you got to have a little. You got to have a little crazy to do writing anyway. So what's going to happen?
Well,
what's going to be held with you for your whole life? But
I still think I might be a little bit of a lunatic, but it's mostly a good lunacy. It's a very happy.
Yeah,
I'm a very happy crazy person. I mean, you know. So.
Yeah. Well, you got to be. You got to have a little crazier. You wouldn't go into any creative field, and I think. And it's not even going into the creative field. You feel called to it, I think, for the most part.
Yeah.
Most people do it because, really, I mean, if you could do, there are a lot of easier ways, and we talk on this show very often because we have a lot of people who are writers and other artists and, or people who want to be, who always are fascinated by what other people go through and the journey and also the practices and so forth. But there certainly are, and I've said this before, and it's no surprise to you, much easier ways to make a living than being a writer. So,
absolutely.
Or an artist of any kind.
I think that's why so many artists will tell people who are looking to get into the arts that if there's anything else that you can do, do it. If there's anything else that you feel like you could live a satisfied life doing, then go do it because it's so hard.
That's a better way to put it, because anything else you can do, anybody can do anything else, but you might be miserable doing it if you're not, you know.
Right, exactly. If you're going to be miserable, then you may as well be happier and broke.
But
if there's anything that you could do with and still be happy, there are, as you say, easier roads, but it's worth it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely worth it. If the payoff is not always in money, sometimes you get the money too, and that's great. And I'm not turning that down if it happens. But there's also just the reward of doing it. But if you're, you know, if you go into it thinking it's going to be a quick killing, then I think you're going to be disappointed. And there is a lot of work involved too. A lot of people feel they romanticize it if they haven't tried it yet. You know, you're so lucky. The ideas just these ideas and characters must just come to you and all this kind of stuff. I'm like, some of it is true. There is some of that magical alchemy that occurs. But that's usually, I always say, that's the reward that you get for putting in the hard work and sitting down and facing that blank page every day. What is your, speaking of that, let's talk a little bit about your practices of writing. What do you do? Do you have a set schedule that you keep? Do you that you adhere to or try to adhere to? How does it work for you?
I tend to write in the morning better than the afternoons. And what I had read this article about, God, I'm going to get the name of it wrong. It was basically about how procrastination can be a good thing for you and that not to beat yourself up for it. And so my process is I get up, I write. If 20 words come out, then 20 words come out. If two chapters come out, two chapters come out. If I hit a block, I'll sometimes binge watch TV or movies, but what I find is that by taking that pressure off of myself and not feeling like, oh, I failed yesterday because I only wrote two sentences, it allows me to write tons the next day. I don't feel like, oh, now I've got to catch up from yesterday. I didn't do what I was supposed to do. I just let it go and write. And then the process has gone so quickly. It literally, for the first draft of my book, it took 3 months to write it. And that was, I mean, part of that's because I had prepared for so long and I'd written an outline and, as I said, 3 years of note-taking and 6 months of procrastination. But so it did go quickly.
And you lived it all those years. You lived it, too. Right? You lived it as a kid.
Exactly. So there was that benefit. But part of the reason why it went quickly in terms of the actual physical writing is simply because I took the pressure off of myself. And I think it's so important to do that. We beat ourselves up, especially artists and writers. We beat ourselves up for every little thing that we feel that we've done wrong. And then it just stops us from moving forward.
That's such a great point. I think you're right. Yeah, just don't worry about it. Just keep going because it's not going to be perfect. That's what I always tell people. You can adhere. You can set yourself up a schedule, which is a great thing to do. Try to adhere to it. If you fall off one day, you fall off one day. If you can't do it, something happens. Your car breaks down. Somebody calls you. You have a crisis. You have to do something. Some people have day jobs, whatever it may be, that get in the way of this. That's okay. Just don't let too much time go by, or else you're going to break the momentum. But you're right. There's no point in beating yourself up over it. Just try to get into the process and try to work at it as best you can, and everybody's different, and you have to find a rhythm that works for you, I think is the key.
Absolutely.
Do you write directly on computer? Do you do longhand, taping? What is your process as
well,
far as that goes?
My note-taking process generally is on notebooks because and pieces of paper. I always carry a notebook.
Not another notebook person. I'm a big pen and paper connection gal.
Well, I'm constantly writing notes to myself. I did recently start emailing myself with my old phone. I've got this old prepaid phone that my friend laughs at me for because I have refused to buy a grown-up phone. But I recently did start texting emails to myself regarding notes for creative things. But mostly I just write it down on a notebook, and then I gather hundreds of pieces of paper that have been scratched upon, and put them all in the computer, and then work from there. For the actual writing of the writing, most of that starts at the computer.
I write my first drafts all longhand.
I don't have another
kindred spirit on that one, but
you only have it on the note taking for me. I'm sorry, I can't.
Yeah.
I cannot
you can't
tell
go,
a lie.
Go with it.
Sorry.
You cannot tell a lie. Okay, listen, whatever works for you. I'm definitely from whatever work school of thought, and that obviously does work for you. What's in the offing? Are you planning on again? Are you continuing a memoir? Do you have fiction in you? What do you want to do next?
Well, I do have fiction in me, and I do have a memoir in me, but I really don't want to do the memoir or the fiction yet. What I'm going to be working on next is an anti-bullying book. I reconnected with a kid with whom I went to school. He was the popular kid, and I was the geek kid, and so I had this idea that we would write a book together about for kids to survive high school and the different perspectives from the popular kid and the geek. So that's one of the books that I've got in the works. And also I'm getting back into doing stand-up comedy, which I did, I started to do while I was in Los Angeles and had some success with it, but I don't like staying up late at night. It makes it really hard to do stand-up comedy. So I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll do that too and kind of get the creative juices going while I'm waiting for this friend of mine and I to get started and just to kind of have some fun being creative, writing, and being out there. So that's
what's
in the
world. To the world. Also connected to the world with comedy, certainly, what's going on.
Absolutely.
Fascinating. Well, I wish you the best. It's a fascinating read, Hiding in Water, a memoir based mostly in reality. Catherine Lippa is our guest. You can find out more about it at your website. I love the name of this website. It's lippalogic.com. Is that right?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Lippa, L-I-P-P-A, logic, all one word, .com. You can also find her on Twitter, the same handle, Facebook, etc. I wish you the best, and I hope
you
come back and see us again.
Oh, thank you so much. I really enjoyed this. Thank you. All right. Take care.
My pleasure. Take care. Bye-bye. Find out more again, lippalogic.com. It is the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. Give us a call, 347-857-4505.
Somebody that just loves to learn, and another child grows up to be somebody you just love to burn. Mom loves the both of them. You see, it's in the blood. Both kids are good and mom. Blood's thicker than the mud. It's a family affair.
It's a family affair.
It's a family affair.
It's a family affair.
What a bear. Each other out. Hey, nobody wants to blow. Nobody wants to be left out.
cause your heart is there. But you can't stay cause you've been somewhere else. You can't cry cause you look broke down. But you're crying anyway cause you're all broke down. It's a family affair.
It's a family affair.
It's a family affair.
It is a family affair. Sly and the Family's Dead on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. Indeed, a family affair told through the eyes of the childhood lens of Catherine Limpa. Find out more about her fascinating memoir, Hiding in Water, a memoir based mostly in reality. Again, check out her website, lippalogic.com. Interesting story, indeed, as all childhoods are. Just have to put the right perspective on it. And she tells it with humor, too. It's quite interesting and quite well-read. All right, so how are you on this Friday? Reach out via Twitter at AB Writes or on the phone line, 347-857-4505. We have the chat up and running. We had a couple of guests who popped in and out. We'll have one guest, 336, in the chat room. So welcome aboard, and thank you. And thank you, guest 406 and guest 435. So no name. I guess if you're not a registered Blog Talk person, you don't pop up as that or something. I don't know how it works, to be honest with you, but we're happy. On the Twitter feed, I got a couple of people. We're trying it anyway. A couple of comments already coming in. Clara says, good interview. We'll check out the book. Thank you very much. Thank you, Clara. Appreciate it. And Shay said, another good one, AB. All right. I always like those pats on the back from the heartier regulars. All right, a couple of programming notes coming up. Starting in September, the show will change the times a little bit. Instead of Mondays, we're going to Tuesdays and Fridays at noon. We will add additional shows as needed. Going to be a tough schedule this fall, but we're going to get through it together, and we've got some great people lined up. Don't forget, the shows are all podcast and archived for on-demand listening at the Blog Talk Radio site. So follow the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show there, download episodes at the BTR site or on iTunes, NetNow, and at the website, amybetharkowitz.com, which is the place to go should you want to be a guest on the show. As I said, we are booking for a fabulous fall season, looking for compelling storytellers of all types, authors and filmmakers, musicians, theater impresarios, social commentators, justice experts, by all means. Hop aboard the website, amybetharkowitz.com, and we'll try to get you on the show. Media Bites has dubbed a top professional podcast, calling it an empowering, entertaining tour de force. We try. We do try. Sometimes it's harder than others days, but we do try. So it was back on this date, August 8th, 1974, when Richard Nixon announced that he would resign. The resignation took effect on August 9th. It was a pretty historic deal. But Nixon was in the cultural consciousness for decades.
Buckle down with Nixon, buckle down. We can win with Nixon if we buckle down. We can always fight when we know we're right, and we know we're right, so buckle down. Make 'em yell for Nixon, make 'em yell. We can win with Nixon if we make 'em yell. If we don't give in, take it on the chin. We can win with Nixon if we'll only knuckle down. He has been to 50 lands across the sea, and they know he stands for peace and liberty. He has friends everywhere, over here, over there. What a president he'll make for you and me. Buckle down with Nixon, buckle down. We can win with Nixon if we buckle down. He has set the pace, we will win the race. Yes, we'll win the race with a Nixon victory.
vintage Nixon ad. He was around for so many years, tried to be president, run in 1960, of course, as you know, failed, came back, the infamous Checker speech, etc. And then Watergate did him in his second term, and of course, you always think about it when you read the history books. He had no reason, really, to get involved with Watergate because he won by a landslide. And of course, he might have also never gotten caught had he not taped everything. Think about that and put it in perspective. But certainly historic, the first president to resign, Richard Nixon. We're going to put it in historic perspective with Bill Curtis. And first, though, Phil Oakes has a few things to say.
Here's to the state of Richard Nixon. For underneath his borders, the devil draws no line. If you drag his muddy rivers, nameless bodies you will find. And the fat trees of the forest have hid a thousand crimes. And the calendar is lying when it reads the present time. Oh, here's to the land you've torn out the heart of. Richard Nixon, find yourself another country to be part of. And here's to the schools of Richard Nixon, where they're teaching all the children that they don't have to care. All the rudiments of hatred are present everywhere, and every single classroom is a factory of despair. Oh, there's nobody learning such a foreign word as fair. Oh, here's to the land you've torn out the heart of. Richard Nixon, find yourself another country to be part of. And here's to the laws of Richard Nixon, where the wars are fought in secret, Pearl Harbor every day. He punishes with income tax that he don't have to pay. And he's tapping his own brother just to hear what he would say. But corruption can be classic in the Richard Nixon way. Oh, here's to the land you've torn out the heart of. Richard Nixon, find yourself another country to be part of. And here's to the churches of Richard Nixon and Billy Graham, where the cross once made of silver now is caked with rust, and the Sunday morning sermons pander to their lust. All the fallen faith of Jesus is choking in the dust, and heaven only knows in which God they can trust. Oh, here's to the land you've torn out the heart of. Richard Nixon, find yourself another country to be part of. And here's to the government of Richard Nixon. In the swamp of their bureaucracy, they're always bogging down. And criminals are posing as advisors to the crown. And they hope that no one sees the sights and no one hears the sound. And the speeches of the president are the ravings of a clown. Oh, here's to the land you've torn out the heart of. Richard Nixon, find yourself another country to be part of.
Richard M. Nixon's career seemed to thrive on paradox. He was a man famous for his lack of personal grace, yet he became the only candidate in U.S. history who was twice elected both president and vice president. In the moments of his greatest triumph, he planted the seeds of future self-destruction, while his most public failures only seemed to gird his determination to mount ever more astonishing comebacks. In November 1972, Nixon was re-elected president in a landslide, carrying 49 of 50 states. But in the midst of that election campaign, Nixon's paranoia and distrust led to his downfall. Determined not to be blindsided by political dirty tricks, he planted one of his own, authorizing a burglary attempt at the Democratic Party headquarters at Washington's Watergate Hotel. The intruders were caught, setting into motion a White House cover-up which would take 2 years to unravel. Yet unravel it did, leading to televised Senate hearings with all the drama of a daily soap opera. By the summer of 1974, many of Nixon's top aides had resigned and were under legal indictment. Finally, a tape recording system Nixon had installed in the White House provided evidence that the president had been involved in the cover-up all along.
This is an NBC News hotline report. This is Steve Porter. The rapidly unfolding events in Washington point to the resignation of President Richard Nixon today. An announcement was made at the White House a short time ago, and on the line with me to discuss that is NBC News White House correspondent Russ Ward in Washington.
Yes, Steve, there's no doubt in anyone's mind now that the resignation announcement will be forthcoming tonight. We were informed at 11 o'clock this morning, Eastern Time, that the president had called the vice president into his Oval Office for a private meeting. That private meeting lasted an hour and 10 minutes. A short time later, Press Secretary Ronald Ziegler came into the briefing room and had this announcement.
Tonight at 9 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time, the President of the United States will address the nation on radio and television from his Oval Office.
Facing near certain impeachment, Nixon spoke on television to the American people on August 8, 1974, and announced that he would become the first president in U.S. history to resign from that office.
I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first. America needs a full-time president and a full-time Congress, particularly at this time with problems we face at home and abroad, to continue to fight through the months ahead for my personal vindication would almost totally absorb the time and attention of both the President and the Congress in a period when our entire focus should be on the great issues of peace abroad and prosperity without inflation at home. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
1 month later, Nixon's successor, Gerald Ford, closed the Watergate saga by granting Nixon a presidential pardon.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have come to a decision which I felt I should tell you and all of my fellow American citizens. As soon as I was certain in my own mind and in my own conscience that it is the right thing to do, there are no historic or legal precedents to which I can turn in this matter, none that precisely fit the circumstances of a private citizen who has resigned the presidency of the United States. Now, therefore, I, Gerald R. Ford, President of the United States, pursuant to the pardon power conferred upon me by Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, have granted, and by these presents do grant, a full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon for all offenses against the United States which he, Richard Nixon, has committed or may have committed or taken part in during the period from July 20, 1969 through August 9, 1974.
For several years after that, Nixon slipped from view, and many observers assumed that his public career had ended at last. And yet, slowly but surely, he came back once more. In 1993, he returned to the House of Representatives and began his speech by humorously echoing General Douglas MacArthur's famous farewell. "Old politicians may die," he told the assembled congressmen, "but they never fade away."
Young Americans, as we remember, are President Nixon and his resignation back on this date, August 8th, 1974. Right here on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show, Bill Curtis, thank you so much for putting it all in perspective for us. And, of course, Phil Oakes with a song that was written and recorded way before Watergate was part of our cultural consciousness. Here's to the state of Richard Nixon, always a controversial, polarizing political figure. And look where we are now. I mean, really, you talk about young Americans, Watergate and that whole era kind of zapped the youth out of our country, the innocence in so many ways, politically and socially. And we're certainly in a very, very different kind of polarized, well, not different because it was polarized, I guess, then too, but just so polarized in so many ways. And the world is certainly at strife. I mean, we have that problem in Iraq, the airstrikes. There's a big political hotbed and hot potato for President Obama, both on the right and left, are already talking about whether we should do it, it's too late, too little, all of that. So if you want more on that, go into the blogosphere, you'll find it. I'm just speechless on this because I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say about it. It's just really horrible the way the state of the world is at the moment. And the Israeli situation and the Hamas and all of that is not good either. But there is some good piece of justice news came down yesterday, the verdict in that case with the man who was charged with murdering the young woman, Renishan McBride, who was looking for help in the middle of the night in that Detroit suburb. Theodore Wafer found guilty of second-degree murder. Nobody bought. The jury certainly didn't buy his self-defense claims. It was a hard case to make because he had to open the door to shoot her. If you're really scared, call 911 and hunker down. And he did not do that. So unfortunately, that young woman is dead, and he will likely spend the rest of his life behind bars. But it does seem like the just verdict in that case. And on a lighter news, it looks like The View will be taken over by a former Rachel Maddow producer. Bill Wolf, is that the guy's name? Bill Wolf, who is the executive producer at MSNBC's Rachel Maddow show. He serves as VP of that news outlet's primetime programming. He's leaving NBC Universal. And according to sources, he will be running The View come the fall, the new View with Rosie O'Donnell, Whoopi Goldberg, and a couple of guests to be named later. But we're not sure. ABC has not confirmed it, but of course he will, if that happens, replace Bill Getty, who created the show along with Barbara Walters and has been the executive producer since it debuted in 1997. Everybody knew Getty was on his way out when Rosie got the gig, because Rosie is not happy with Bill Getty after that split-screen confrontation with Elizabeth Hasselhoff. Hasselbeck. Excuse me. So anyway, that's what's happening at The View. And the other thing that's happening in a lighter note for fun news, or lighter news, maybe not fun for the guy involved, but there's a big question. If a monkey takes a selfie, who owns the copyright? And can you have a copyright? There's a guy named David Slater back in 2011. He's a British photographer. He traveled to Indonesia and took a picture of the crested black maki, a snouty primate with reddish, somewhat possessed-looking eyes. He's seen these photos. And during the expedition, a fortune struck when, in the words of the Telegraph in England, one of the animals came up to investigate his equipment, hijacked a camera, and took hundreds of selfies. Now, miraculously, at least one of those shots turned out absolutely superb, and now everybody is using it without paying him anything. He claims that he has the right to the copyright, and he could, in fact, fetch something like $100,000 or $150,000 for it. But places like Wikipedia, who have been running it, say a monkey took it, and monkeys have no legal standing to get a copyright. Wow. Slater is fighting with the Wikimedia Foundation, which has posted the photo online in a bunch of places, including Wikipedia. The trip, he said, cost me about £2,000 for that monkey shot, not to mention the $5,000 of equipment I carried, the insurance, the computer stuff I used to process the images. Photography is an expensive profession and being encroached upon. They're taking our livelihoods away, he said. For every 10,000 images I take, one makes money that keeps me going, and that was the one of those images. It really was like a year of work, and he wants to have the copyright. What do you think? If the monkey took the picture, but he was the one who facilitated the monkey taking the picture, should he get the copyright? I don't know, man. Kind of feel sorry for this guy. Too much monkey business for me. I'm Amy with the Darkwave Show.
Running to and fro, hard working at the mill, never fail in the mail, yet come a rotten bill. Too much monkey business, too much monkey business, too much monkey business for me to be involved in. Salesman talking to me, trying to run me up a creek, say you can buy it, go on, try it, you can pay me next week. Ah, too much monkey business, too much monkey business, too much monkey business for me to be involved in. Blind, half good looking, trying to get me hooked, want me to marry, get a home, settle down, write a book. Too much monkey business, too much monkey business, too much monkey business for me to be involved in. Same thing every day, getting up, going to school, no need of me complaining, my objections overrule. Ah, too much monkey business, too much monkey business, too much monkey business for me to be involved.
Monkey Don't Stop No Show on the Amy Beth Harkaway Show, but it might interfere with our British photographer David Slater's payday. And Chuck Berry is too much monkey business, too. I'm kind of siding with Slater on this one. He went out there. He got the work done, essentially. I think he should get paid for that picture. Just my opinion. What do you think? Reach out via Twitter at AB Writes or on the studio line 347-857-4505. A couple of tweets coming in. Nixie says, not taking offense at the Nixon tribute, but good show. Thank you, Nixie. No offense indeed intended. Paulie says, I remember Nixon resigning in high school watching those Watergate hearings. Allude to him. All right. Now we know how old you are, Paulie. And Phelps says, enjoyed the interview. We'll check out Catherine's book. Indeed, Catherine Lippa's book, Hiding in Water, is a fascinating read. Catherine also checked in saying she'd enjoyed her visit, as we did as well. Thank you so much again to visiting with us. Find out more at lippalogic.com. So what else is happening in the news? Oh, I wanted to mention the passing of James Brady, Ronald Reagan's former press secretary, who took a bullet for Reagan during that horrible assassination attempt by John Hinckley back in 1981. He died last Monday at the age of 73. He became a valiant supporter and crusader for better gun rights, the Brady Bill, et cetera, with his wife Sarah. Struggled with so many physical problems in his life, he passed away on Monday at the age of 73. So, good work, Mr. Brady, indeed. And a lot of people in the press who worked with him remembered him quite fondly over the week. So we forgot to mention it on Tuesday. I just wanted to pay tribute. We've had so many goodbyes this summer with so many luminaries and people in the news that it's sad, but it is a cycle of life, people coming, people going, and how it works out. But I'd like to pay tribute to those who we can remember, fondly or notoriously, as the case may be, in the case of Richard Nixon, certainly, in that resignation. I saw Carl Bernstein today on CNN. They have a special, I think, on CNN that will be running, if they can, if the news doesn't take them away. And I saw that fascinating HBO documentary, which was essentially Richard Nixon, in his own words, from those tapes that he made, those notorious tapes that haunted him to his dying day, for sure. And I think the taping, we mentioned this on Tuesday's show, the taping started, I think, taping all conversations in the White House, or certainly the Oval Office, with President Johnson. And I guess the practice was just continued. I don't know if they do it to this day. It would be fascinating to hear some of the conversations that President Obama has. Or maybe not. He's taking a beating on all kinds of sides. Do you think he wants to leave office? He probably doesn't want to leave office with all his unfinished business, but he's probably had enough, I think. And the kids probably have enough, too. The older daughter is headed to college pretty soon, so I'm sure she doesn't want to have Secret Service hovering over her, although I guess she will anyway, whether they're in office or not, because they'll have Secret Service protection for several years. If you're a Mets fan, sorry news. They just dropped 2 out of 3 to the Nationals. They rally, and then they just can't make it stick. It's like that line from Brokeback Mountain. I wish I could quit them, but I can't. We'll see what happens. They take on the Phillies 4 games at home. I believe they're at home taking on the Phillies. They're at Philly taking on the Phillies, and they come home and take on the Nationals again. And they pretty much have to win at least 5 out of 7 of those games to have any hopes of surviving. And if they drop a lot to the Phillies, they may even wind up in last place, which would be a real shame. So, yeah, Trudy, we're going to whip this one out again for you. When you're hot, you're hot. And hey, when you're not, you're not. And they're not.
Well, now me and Homer Jones and Big John Talley had a big crap game going back in the alley. And I kept rolling them 7 and winning all them pots. My luck was so good I could do no wrong. I just kept on rolling and controlling them bones. Finally they just threw up their hand and said, when you hot, you hot. I said, yeah.
When you're hot, you're hot. And when you're not, you're not.
Something behind me. I turned around and there was a big old cop. He said, hello, boys. Then he gave us a grin and said, look like I'm gonna have to haul y'all in and keep all that money for evidence. I said, well, son, when you hot, you hot. He said, yeah,
when you're hot, you're hot. When you're not, you're not.
You can explain it all down at City Hall. I said, yeah,
when you're hot,
you're hot.
The
core.
the judge was a fishing buddy that I recognized. I said, hey, judge, old buddy, old pal, I'll pay you that $100 all year if you get me out of this spot. So he gave my friends a little fine to pay. He turned around and grinned at me and said, 90 days, Jerry, when you hot, you hot. And I said, thanks a lot.
When you hot, you hot. When you not, you not.
He let my friends go free and throw the book at me. He said, well, when you hot, you hot. I said, well, I'll tell you one thing, judge, old buddy, old pal. If you wasn't wearing that black robe, I'd take you out back at his courthouse and I'd try a little bit of your honor on. You understand that, you hillbilly? Who's gonna collect my welfare? Pay for my Cadillac? What do you mean, contempt of court?
And they're not hot, that's for sure. The song truly has to whip out every time the Mets are in something of a slump. Jerry Reed, when you're hot, you're hot. And when you're not, you're not. I'm the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. A few minutes left here on the show. I want to look at our Inspiration to Action shout-out today to Devin in Geneva, New York, who writes, working on a memoir, lots of family secrets to sift through. It's tough, but the Inspiration to Action challenge got me focused and helped me access a more generous spirit. Well, very nicely put, Devin. That is part of what it's about, is to get you more focused on your creativity, open yourself up to all kinds of inspirations in a very generous way to yourself and to others in the world. Basically, the quick primer on this, and we've gone over it so many times, I hate to always do it on the air, but I'll just give you one because we haven't done it in a while. Get yourself a notebook if you haven't done it yet. And every single day, just write down one thing that brings you sheer joy, one thing that inspires you, one thing for which you are grateful. And one or two, maybe three times a week, weave in an act of kindness that you've bestowed upon someone or someone's bestowed upon you. And while you're at it, you might want to chart your feelings. Do you feel differently as you're doing this? Good, bad feelings, good feelings, what happens? And does it really spark you and get your creative juices flowing? It's really intended to do that. It has worked for a lot of people. Can't promise a panacea, but try it. Give yourself a couple of weeks, and I think you're going to start looking at things differently and start approaching your own creative work, whatever it may be, writing, painting, gardening, music, filmmaking, photography, just your life a lot differently. And if it is working for you, I'd love to give you a shout-out. Just send it to us here at the website, amybetharkowi.com. Just tell me how it's helping you. And if you need a little help, a little cajoling in that area or other creativity coaching and counseling questions, by all means, reach out. Also at the website. And the first conversation is always on me, indeed. And while you're there, peruse the Eliza Gordon Mystery Series, My Stories, both Killing Time and Dead Silent, available for ebook download and paperback, told they make great beach reads. And, yeah, I'm kind of working on number three, but I'm stalled a little bit because maybe I don't want to know what happens. My story, and I am indeed sticking to it. Thank you so much to, again, Catherine Lippa for joining us, Trudy and Aurora from the TCS headquarters in the booth, ML at headquarters. I appreciate you all being here on the Twitter feed. Always a pleasure. The chat room, we only had a few people, but we'll try it again, see if it works. Don't forget you can follow the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show at the Blog Talk Radio site. Download episodes there are iTunes and NetNow. At the website, as I said, amybetharkowitz.com. 24/7 conversation at Twitter. Friend me on Facebook. You want to find me. Heck, you'll find me. You'll find me so fast you want to run away in the other direction. We're going to leave you with a couple of songs. Leftovers for our Name Games edition. I'm going to start with this one. Etta James and Dance With Me, Henry. We'll talk to you. We may have a pop-up coffee clash next week. Otherwise, we'll see you on August 20th. But you'll meet... you'll meet Americana duo Bradford Loomis and Beth Whitney. Well, the song kind of started too soon. Is that what the problem was? Anyway, here's Etta James and Dance With Me, Henry. For Frank on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show, have a great weekend. Drive safe, play nice, dream big. Come back and see us again. I'm the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show.
It's an all-new celebrity edition of Crossing Over, as John Edward makes contact with the dead careers of has-been actors.
I'm contacting the career of Richard Dreyfuss. Richard, what would you like to ask your dead career?
It seems like only yesterday. I was with the fish. I was with the flying saucers. Now, nothing. Ho-ho-ho.
I'm seeing the top right corner of the Hollywood Squares.
Oh, boy. Is that the best it can do? Give me the phone.
Celebrity Crossing Over. Next week, Joe Pesci.
I'm sorry, Joe. Your career has crossed too far over to make contact.
Okay. I'm coming over there, and I'm busting a few heads.
time to repress another memory.
It was the 3rd of June, another sleepy, dusty Delta day. I was out chopping cotton and my brother was baling hay. And at dinner time we stopped and walked back to the house to eat. And Mama hollered at the back door, y'all remember to wipe your feet. And then she said, I got some news this morning from Choctaw Ridge. Today Billy Joe McAllister jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. Papa said to Mama as he passed around the black-eyed peas, well, Billy Joe never had a lick of sense, pass the biscuits, please. There's 5 more acres in the lower 40 I got to plow. And Mama said it was a shame about Billy Joe anyhow. Like nothing ever comes to no good up on Choctaw Ridge. And now Billy Joe McAllister jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. Brother said he recollected when he and Tom and Billy Joe put a frog down my back at the Carroll County Picture Show. Wasn't I talking to him at the church last Sunday night? I'll have another piece of apple pie. You know it don't seem right. I saw him at the sawmill yesterday on Choctaw Ridge. And now you tell me Billy Joe's jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. Mama said to me, child, what happened to your appetite? Well, I've been cooking all morning and you haven't touched a single bite. That nice young preacher, Brother Taylor, dropped by today. Said he'd be pleased to have dinner on Sunday. Oh, by the way, he said he saw a girl that looked a lot like you up on Choctaw Ridge. And she and Billy Joe was throwing something off the Tallahatchie Bridge. A year has come and gone since we heard the news about Billy Joe. Brother married Becky Thompson, they bought a store in Tupelo. There was a virus going round, Papa caught it and he died last spring. And now Mama doesn't seem to want to do much of anything. And me, I spend a lot of time picking flowers up on Choctaw Ridge and drop them into the muddy water off the Tallahatchie Bridge.